to the Coalition for Physician Wellbeing's podcast, The Wellbeing Connector, where through our guests we explore ideas for making healthcare a better place to work and serve. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by an associate professor at Illinois Institute of Technology, Arlen Moeller. Arlen is a social psychologist by training, and his research is focused mainly on human motivation and behavioral medicine. After completing his PhD at the University of Rochester in 2007, he was briefly a professor at Gettysburg College in central Pennsylvania before moving to Chicago in 2009 to join the Department of Preventive Medicine at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine. After 5 years there, he moved just a few miles down the road to the Illinois Institute of Technology, where his research has focused on emerging technologies and how they are used to either promote or undermine behavioral health. From 2018 to 2021, with funding from the American Medical Association, he collaborated with a cross-disciplinary team of researchers on a large study of U.S. physicians' occupational health. The focus of this work centered on physicians' work motivation as a key predictor of their mental well-being and turnover intentions. Well, thank you, Arlen, for joining us today. I'm so glad you're able to be here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Michael.
So I wanted to begin. Your research interest is relatively broad. Could you just talk a little bit about what are you studying, and then how did this your field of research bring you to your interest in physician well-being?
Sure. Happy to. So my background and graduate training is in social and health psychology. And I was focused broadly on how human motivation affects people's health and well-being. And so that, you know, can be applied in lots of contexts at work, at school. I was focusing on motivation for health behavior change. So I spent time at Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern, developing health behavior interventions that targeted physical activity and diet, smoking cessation, but was always looking at sort of the qualities of the motivation of participants in those studies, because the motivation itself affects people's well-being, sort of the type of motivation that is driving you to make those changes. And it also, in the long run, affects how sustainable health behavior changes are. And so I was doing that work and was invited a number of years ago to collaborate with a team that was organized by the AMA to look at physicians' occupational health. I think there's now wide recognition that there's high rates of burnout and even intentions to leave medicine among practicing U.S. physicians. And so I got involved in working with a team to survey over 2,000 working practicing U.S. physicians to try to understand better their work motivation and how that influenced their health and well-being.
Well, wonderful. So I got in touch with you because after having read your article, Motivational Mechanisms Underlying Physician Occupational Health, a Self-Determination Theory Perspective. Can you talk a little bit about what is self-determination theory and how so we can talk about how it applies to physician well-being?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. That theory is sort of the centerpiece for the research that we did. And it's really, you know, considered, you know, one of the largest theories of motivation in terms of contemporary psychological science. We're actually just a few weeks away from an international conference that will be in Orlando, end of May into early June, with thousands of researchers from around the world working with this theory called self-determination theory that has developed over the last almost 50 years, beginning. So the earliest studies on it were published in the very early 1970s. And It's a theory that came out of sort of a response to classic behaviorist theories of motivation. So theories, we talked about B.F. Skinner earlier, theories that focus on rewards, threats of punishment as important factors that influence people's motivation. And, you know, towards the late 1960s, early 1970s, there what began to be sort of accumulating evidence that there are categories of behavior and motivation that weren't explained well by those classic behaviorist theories. And they initially identified a type of motivation called intrinsic motivation as a subtype of motivation that really isn't explained well by rewards and punishments. And the principle was that there are some behaviors that people find rewarding in and of themselves, that the behavior itself is the reward. And so, you know, we think of play in particular, and children at play who sometimes, you know, will exhaust themselves working with blocks or building a snow fort with no promise of a reward or threat of punishment, but that the activity itself is the reward. And, you know, in the decades since, this idea of alternative or different types of motivation being something that's important for understanding human behavior and health has sort of grown in complexity. So I'll pause there to see if you're with me.
Oh, I'm with you. Just want to hear some of the issues in terms of what determines intrinsic motivation, and then want to get into a little bit about how that relates back to your study in terms of physicians.
Sure. So in terms of, like, you know, what seems to be predicting people experiencing intrinsic motivation, the theory has sort of coalesced around evidence that there are basic psychological needs that appear to be relatively universal across different cultures and across, you know, different phases of human development across the life course. And that when these psychological needs are being satisfied, that seems to fuel this experience of intrinsic motivation and the positive emotions that accompany being motivated in this way. And so the three psychological needs that there's sort of consensus around in self-determination theory are the needs for autonomy, a need for competence, and a need for relatedness. And I can say a little more about that because sometimes the definitions of those psychological needs leave room for different interpretations. And, you know, over the last, you know, 4 to 5 decades, the definitions have been refined, I think, through the feedback of empirical testing and evidence building. And so we've arrived at, I think, you know, more precise definitions of what these basic psychological needs really are all about.
Okay, so let's cover each one at a time, and let's see how it might apply in different environments.
Yeah, for sure. So the first one, the need for autonomy, is maybe the most central and the most controversial in the psychological science literature. And the idea here is that human beings have evolved to feel, to need to feel that they are sort of the directors or origins of their actions. And so the flip side of that is that when we feel coerced or forced into doing something, that we have a negative reaction to that. That's thwarting this basic psychological need.
Is that implying that people want to be independent?
And that is a great question. And I think that that was a source of sort of a direct empirical testing, sort of over the course of developing this theory. There has been drawn a distinction between feeling independent and feeling autonomous. And I think initially, if you read some of the writing in the 1970s and 1980s, the language sort of uses those terms in ways that blurs the distinction. But more recently, the definition of autonomy within this theory of motivation is refined to mean that really what it's about is endorsing the actions that you're engaging in, the work that you're doing or activity you're engaged in. And it is possible that if you trust and respect or even see someone as an extension of yourselves, maybe a parent that you're close with, that another person could make choices about the activity and you could wholeheartedly endorse those choices and thus feel fully autonomous.
So in a work environment where you have to work with a lot of people and you have to all row in the same direction, what does it mean to have an environment that's more autonomy supportive?
Well, it has to do with consensus building. Communicating to members of maybe a diverse team that their input is respected, to some degree, just structurally, democratic forms of governance facilitate feeling autonomous. In an organization, that if there's some opportunity to have your say, even if the group decides something else, there are different ways structurally and through words and communication style that convey respect for team members' autonomy. And so those are some of the things we look for if we're trying to support the satisfaction of that.
I guess we can talk about that a little bit more when we talk about your study, but let's get to the other two major factors within self-determination theory.
Sure. So then the second one is that it looks like human beings and even related primates evolved at some point a need to experience competence, to feel a sense of mastery over activities or aspects of our environment. Initially that was understood, I think, in a relatively limited way that, if you feel like you're good at something, that you're skilled, that you would be satisfying this need. But it turns out that it's a little more nuanced than that, that the real satisfaction of this need for competence is about feeling like you're being challenged. Optimally challenged, and your ability is being stretched in some way so that you're growing in competence. And so, I use the example of playing tic-tac-toe with my nephews. I have nephews that are 5 and 6 years old. I can feel quite competent in one sense or skilled when I play them. And win every single game. I could win 10 out of 10. But it gets boring for me because it's not challenging. And so what we see in work settings and in play settings is that the really engaging, enjoyable tasks are ones that are optimally challenging in terms of letting us feel like we're stretching our competence, either mentally or physically.
Interesting. Wonderful. So, and the third factor?
Right. And so the third psychological need that I think is maybe the least controversial and most studied is a basic psychological need for relatedness. And this is the idea that human beings are evolved as social animals, that we need to feel connected to other human beings, and that when we are isolated or rejected, that we suffer terribly, psychologically and physically. And that has been, you know, demonstrated in really profound ways and lots of contexts. You know, we know, you know, one of the limiting factors in our space program historically has been the toll that space travel takes in terms of social isolation for astronauts, as sort of one context. In our criminal justice system, I mean, many of your listeners, I'm sure, are aware that we use as a next level form of punishment after taking away people's autonomy and putting them in prisons. Within prisons, a more severe punishment is to put people in solitary confinement. And many people find that inhumane and a practice that should be ended. And I think some of the arguments for that is that the need for relatedness is really fundamental to our health.
So how does this apply to the healthcare environment? And again, I want to get back to your paper you wrote, what I mentioned earlier. What have you found?
Sure. So we, you know, conducted this research in collaboration with the AMA, and a survey was shared with several thousand practicing U.S. physicians. And we asked a range of questions about work motivation and a range of different occupational health outcomes. So we asked about burnout. We asked about intentions to leave their practice, immediate work environment, and their intentions to leave medicine altogether. And we also asked about depression risk and physical health symptoms. And what we found is that the satisfaction of or lack of satisfaction of these psychological needs in their work environment was strong predictors of this wide range of occupational health outcomes. And this was mediated through a type of motivation that we call autonomous motivation, which I'd be happy to share a little more about.
Please.
Sort of another aspect of this. So I mentioned when I was introducing this macro theory of motivation called self-determination theory, that the origins were related to intrinsic motivation. When we're the reward is just the activity itself, which includes, you know, categories of play and fun activities. Well, that's an important sort of category of motivation, but, you know, of course, in most work settings, your day is not all fun and games. There are, you know, challenging activities that are important, but aren't going to be necessarily enjoyable and fun. And so over the decades, self-determination theory recognizes that extrinsic forms of motivation can be internalized to varying degrees and feel either more autonomous or less autonomous. And so autonomous extrinsic motivation is when people are engaged with a work activity and their motivation is derived from valuing some aspects of the work, that they find their work meaningful, even if not fun. And it turns out that kind of internalized extrinsic motivation is also predicted by the satisfaction of these same three basic psychological needs.
So one of the things I like about this theory, and again, we may be going beyond what the research can show, is that it implies there are things that can be done to create environments that are more promoting of well-being. When you have an environment where people have their intrinsic motivational needs met, they will hopefully be doing better and have less of the negative consequences we're trying to avoid. Absolutely. Can you talk about some of the implications of what kind of, for example, leaders within health systems do to create an environment that supports either autonomy, relatedness, or competence?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, I like to think about interventions in any organization in a sort of multifaceted system-oriented lens. But, you know, the most proximal sort of factors in terms of having a direct impact on workers, in this case physicians, are their direct supervisors. And so there have been, you know, more than dozens, really hundreds of studies across different work organizations that have demonstrated that the communication style employed by direct supervisors is one of the more powerful predictors of psychological need satisfaction for those workers.
Can you say more about that? What's the style that is most beneficial? What is it related to one of the three needs, or is it more one of the needs?
Yeah, well, I think that you know, a lot of times the there's certainly work that speaks to communication style that's supportive of each of the three psychological needs. But I'll focus on autonomy. Support, autonomy, supportive communication as sort of the first example. We can, you know, train human coders or use, you know, computer algorithms and natural language processing to detect the fact that certain words that people, that a supervisor might use are predictive of the worker feeling more autonomy supported or less autonomy supported.
Can you give examples? What kind of words are used that kind of make that indication?
Yeah, so I can even share maybe after the call a dictionary of words that's that would be used. You know, 50 to 100 words that are more associated with autonomy support, and by contrast, 50 to 100 words that are associated with communication style we would categorize as controlling.
Oh, I'd love to
coercive.
See that.
Sure. Yeah, that's actually some of the work I'm going to present at this conference in 2 weeks is using some of those tools. But, you know, words that convey respect and the possibility of choice. Even so saying, you know, you could do this versus you should or must do this would be sort of one sort of place in a sentence where the language could be shifted. Or, you know, inviting people to consider changing their behavior at work in some way. And the presence or absence of rationale that is, you know, potentially meaningful for the worker is important. So if the rationale is because I said so, and you may be fired if you don't listen to what I say, that's a relatively coercive, you know, communication style. If the sort of the suggestion of, you know, using the electronic medical record in some way that may be new or different is offered with some choice about it. We'd like you to try this, and also some effort to offer a rationale that the physician may value themselves. That would be sort of a strategy we consider like autonomy supportive communication.
Very nice. So that's the work to recognize various communication styles. Are you also seeing people making efforts to train people on the to change their style or shift their style?
Oh, yeah. So that is another great question. And there's a great paper that came out maybe a year, maybe 2 years ago now that was, an interesting study design to that I was feel fortunate to be a part of. The participants in a study on this were all researchers who are involved with behavioral medicine interventions. It was led by a professor at the University of Lisbon named Pedro Teixeira. I can share with you the reference after the call, but it was looking at very specific motivation and behavior change techniques that can be used by coaches or health professionals to very specifically and concretely support these three psychological needs. And the context for the paper was a health behavior change interventions. But I think that the techniques translate very easily to how a manager can think about communicating to employees. And I think that paper is one of the best resources available in terms of giving really concrete advice about how you would actually, where the rubber hits the road, how you would do this.
And if a manager uses more autonomy supportive language or communicates more autonomy supportively, does that imply they have to give away their authority, that they're kind of now no longer in as much control?
Not at all. And I think that there is, a lot of misunderstanding in terms of the possibility that autonomy supportive management or communication might imply anarchy or, just sort of letting go of the reins of an organization. There's a distinction drawn between being controlling or coercive versus providing structure, limits, rules. And so those sort of ideas are considered orthogonal or independent in this theory. And we take as a starting place that organizations, work organizations, school settings are going to have rules and regulations that, people ultimately have to sometimes abide by. But that there can be a lot of variability in how you communicate those limits, those rules, the structure, really, that is going to be in place in the organization.
Very nice. So I want to step back a little bit. We're talking now within the organization. I want to talk more a little about the health system that throughout the country, physicians are in challenging environments. So what's going on and what can be done to improve the system of healthcare that would help physicians from the perspective of someone thinking about self-determination theory?
Boy, indeed. And Michael, you ask a great and incredibly complex question. I think that there is growing consensus that, there are system level changes that are appropriate to try to really adequately confront the what I consider the crisis of healthcare professionals' occupational health. Not just for physicians, but really across this professional setting, there's evidence that it's a growing problem. And so, in the research I was doing with the AMA, we looked at, different structural factors that could be, considered and maybe that have changed over the years. And one of them that I think is interesting is a real sea change in terms of the percentage of practicing physicians in the United States who have an ownership stake in their practice. And the data show that we reached a tipping point a number of years ago, maybe 5 to 10 years ago, where the where previously the majority of physicians had some ownership over their practice, and the trend, a strong trend, has been to have healthcare practices that are managed by sometimes large corporations. And so you have sort of a rise of hospitalists and sort of physicians as employees. And one of the consequences of that, that doesn't necessarily have to be a problem, but it looks like a consequence of that, is that physicians have surrendered some degree of autonomy in their work, that the sort of different aspects of their work life is now being dictated to them more as employees than previously. And this may be one of the factors contributing to poor occupational health.
Is there any relation to larger organizations in that regard? Because one of the things I think about is some of these large organizations, your boss's boss may lack the authority to act on what you're suggesting as well. Is that kind of a, would that fit into what you're saying?
I think that the more an employee, a physician or any employee, is alienated from important decision making about how their work will be done, you know, the more potential for harm, the more they're, the less they'll feel autonomous at work. And so to the degree that we have, you know, some medical practices that are managed by large corporations, and so there's sort of the decision-making is being filtered down through multiple levels, I think that that on average is going to be more harmful to physicians' occupational health.
But it sounds like you're not just saying it's the size maybe combined with the governance of how well
that's right.
they're involved and incorporated into the decision-making process. So is there not a democracy, but something where they're brought in some sense to be part of the decision-making process?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, since I'm a psychologist, I think of the experience. And so does the physician feel empowered, you know, to have some say or input over what their day-to-day work environment would be like? I know in California, there's been some limits placed on corporations managing healthcare practices. I've mentioned, I think, to you previously before today that in the American legal profession, the American Bar Association has much more stringent rules about who can manage a large law practice. They see it as, you know, ethically problematic to have individuals without legal training and training in the ethics of legal practice managing law practices. And so that you know, is just sort of one thing that, you know, empowers potentially lawyers, even at large firms, relative to U.S. physicians.
Well, I hate to say it, our half hour is almost up, or our time is almost up. Any closing thoughts or reflections you'd like to share?
Boy, well, we covered a lot. I think that there is, you know, certainly a lot of interest in confronting this issue. You know, we have issues with burnout in the United States across sectors of the economy. But, you know, healthcare workers are, you know, at the front line protecting all of us. So when healthcare workers are are burned out and leaving the profession, it's really a public health crisis for the whole country. And so, you know, I consider this a real sort of all hands on deck situation in terms of confronting and considering really, you know, major reform to how we manage healthcare in our country. And I would love to see physicians empowered to be the ones leading those changes. So I know your listeners include, you know, many powerful leaders in the healthcare sector. And, you know, I think that these are the folks who should be, you know, leading and experimenting with new models. Could be cooperatives, could be, you know, ways to sort of elicit in meaningful ways feedback from employee physicians and empower them to a greater extent. But, you know, I'm hopeful that I work with a lot of undergraduate students at IIT that are pre-med. And I know, you know, some of the best and brightest students, despite the warning signs, are still, you know, hard driving to enter medicine, enter the profession. I know there was an increase in applications to medical schools in the middle of the pandemic. And I see that as a good sign that we have, you know, a lot of people who want to get into medicine for the right reasons. And I think we owe them creating a system that will support their health and well-being to do that work.
Wonderful. So with that, I want to thank you for joining us today, for sharing your words of wisdom. This has been great.
Oh, my pleasure, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show for today. I want to thank Professor Arlen Moeller for joining us today and for sharing both his insights and personal story. In today's podcast, Professor Moeller mentioned references that he'd be sharing with me. If you'd like copies of these references, email me at mbrown@acesis.com. That's mbrown@acesis.com, and I'd be happy to share what he has sent me.
If you wish to learn more about the Coalition, please visit our website at www.forphysicianwellbeing.org. You can also check us out on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. I also want to thank our volunteers and the staff from the Coalition who made this podcast possible. Finally, I'd like to thank ACESIS, ACESIS Incorporated, for sponsoring my time working on this podcast. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and his guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Coalition for Physician Wellbeing, its board, or other members of the Coalition. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Brown, wishing our caregivers out there meaning, purpose, and joy in the practice of medicine. Together we are stronger. Until next time.